Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, it's Karen Snyder from Kansas City, home of Taylor Swift's favorite team and Super Bowl champions, the Chiefs. Welcome to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, introduced today by Karen and her husband, Paul, who says they are both huge pod fans and avid tennis players. So thank you, Karen, from one NFL fan to another. And also thank you for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast. We come to you, myself, David and Matt, with new tech this week. We were supposed to start recording about an hour ago, but the tech setup took a little bit longer than anticipated. But we had a fun week, Matt and I, in Solihull last week, choosing new tech, like kids in sweet shops, and generally making all sorts of exciting plans for the very near future, David.
Yes, we did. I mean, first of all, it was absolutely lovely having all three of you, and I include Billie Jean in that number, up here in my humble abode, hanging out with my kids, annoying one of my kids by beating him 6-0 in his favourite sports game, and then capping it off with an overhead kick, Matt. But apart from that, was forgiven, I'm happy to say. How are you, Matt? Have you been practicing your FC24 or whatever it is?
Yeah, an overhead kick to make it 6-0 after 60 minutes just didn't go down well. Still not quite sure how I managed to do an overhead kick, but I did. But then you beat me, David. You've been very humble there.
Yes.
Yeah, dear listener, do enjoy the fruits of these most recent meetings, because after bullying Matt, David's 12-year-old, Matt will never be invited back up to Solihull.
I hope we did enough planning, because it's not going to be repeated.
We did, in between Matt doing that, we did make some fun plans. We finalised our schedule of live shows for the year. We're going to be doing one a month for Friends of the Pod, and February's one is it still going to be February, or is it going to be early March by then?
We make it on February 29th, Catherine.
It's on Thursday. Oh, okay. Right. So in any other year, it would be March the 1st. Well, or in 75% of other years. You get what I'm saying. It's a leap year. And we'll be recording our next live show for Friends of the Tennis Podcast on Thursday. And this week's, can I say the theme, David?
You can indeed.
The theme for this one is things we would change about tennis. And I promise it won't be just an hour-long rant about faff, but I also promise there will be a rant about faff in there somewhere. So the next one, that's this Thursday, 29th of February at 8:30 p.m. UK time. That's 9:30 Central European time, 3:30 on the East Coast in the US, 12:30 on the West Coast in US. Pam, that one's for you. And 7:30 a.m. AEDT, whatever that stands for. So that's coming on Thursday. We've also got a second edition of Tennis Relived coming for Friends. That'll be out in early March, and it'll be focused on focusing on the extraordinary life and career of Ted Tinling, a fashion designer and author, and yes, you heard this right, a spy, who played a very critical role in the early days of building the WTA. He designed dresses for many of the top players, including the dress that Billie Jean King wore for the 1973 Battle of the Sexes, and many, many other iconic dresses as well. We're going to be producing 8 editions of Tennis Relived in total in 2024. Our plans for those are now set in stone. We had a lot of fun choosing them. And friends will also, as I said, get a monthly live show on YouTube to be part of with us, an exclusive review show after each and every Grand Slam tournament, and access to Hannah's column, the second of which published a couple of weeks ago, featuring, focusing on rather, Daria Kazatkina. It's a cracker, of course, because it's Hannah and everything she does is brilliant. We've also now decided to record our podcast reviewing Breakpoint from Netflix and a load of other new tennis documentaries. It's going to be a kind of docu-special. And that's going to be in a special show for Friends of the Tennis Podcast recorded in early April. So if you're a friend, you get all of that and lots more as well. Access to the new Friends community space that we're getting very close to launching. That'll be up in just a few weeks' time. And prices start at £5 per month or £50 per year. It's a bit more if you'd like a shout out or an intro, but you can become a friend at whatever level you like by going to tennis.supportingcast.fm, tennis.supportingcast.fm, or the link is in our notes, the show notes to this podcast. That's your admin done and dusted. Billie Jean has just settled down for a nap on the new my new podcast studio incorporates a dog bed, which is, it's a pretty niche design, but I'm pretty happy with it. Feeling a bit anxious about my proximity to Billie Jean at the moment, given what she rolled in on the walk a short while ago. But we'll press on and see how we go. Let's talk about some tennis, and let's start in Dubai, where good draw Jasmine Paolini is now a WTA 1000 champion. She beat Anna Kalinskaya 4-6, 7-5, 7-5, a massive comeback win, which is so fitting for Jasmine Paolini, isn't it? To win by far the biggest title of her career. Also, on the run to the final, she beat Beatriz Adajmaya, Leila Fernandez, Maria Sakkari, and Sorana Castella. She got the slight slice of luck with a walkover from Elena Rybakina, who withdrew with illness ahead of their matchup. But you cannot argue with those names that she's beaten and the way that she has beaten them. David, how would you describe Jasmine Paolini now?
Champion. That's how I'd describe her. I mean, look, she, you also forgot to mention that she got a 6-love win over me, because she may be like an absolute fool for calling her a good draw. Can anybody remember when and why and against whom I referred to her as a good draw? Because I can't.
It was on the eve of Wimbledon, wasn't it? I remember us being on the roof at Wimbledon, and it was talking about somebody, I think it might have been a comeback player, somebody needing a good draw. Like, imagine if they got a good draw, like, say, .. Jasmine Paolini. Is that right, Matt? No.
I believe it was, we were looking for a potential good draw for Venus Williams.
There we go. Honestly, yeah. I'm not just saying this to rag on you, David, although that is an added bonus. I genuinely think her sort of rising trajectory, the beginning of it coincides exactly with you saying that.
Well, I deserve it. And she's a great watch. My only regret about this final is that I didn't get to see it live. And I'm afraid I am going to have a bit of a rant about the WTA YouTube highlights here, because I went to watch those and in no way did they tell me the story of that final. And in no way did they do those players justice, because they showed 5 minutes of highlights from a match of 2.5 hours, which finished 4-6, 7-5, 7-5, and which saw Paolini down 5-3 in the deciding set, coming back, winning all the remaining games to win it 7-5. And those highlights went from 3-5, win a point, 6-5 match point. So we missed all the, and that was just to hold serve, the 3-5 game. So we missed the break, the two breaks of serve. We didn't see the reasons in those highlights why the comeback happened. Look, it's also on me. I didn't watch the match live, but it's a shame that they couldn't do a better job at really presenting that match to anybody who wants to go back and see how Paolini managed to win that title. What I can tell you is that the couple of points that really showed off her skill and her ability revealed, and I'd be very curious to know what Matt's view of this is of her backhand, because she hit a couple of absolute screaming winners off the backhand down the line with very little noticeable force being applied. They were just clean hits, and so those struck me. And then watching just the sheer joy on her face at the end was wonderful. Actually, she's a great watch. She's yet another example of Italy producing excellent tennis players. And I was wrong, folks. She is not a good draw. She's a bloody nightmare, and she's a really, really good player.
I think what you might be saying there, David, is that Jasmine Paolini this week has made a play for both the intensity list and the backhand list. I was going to, she's at the very least on my intensity watch list. She might even have muscled her way onto the intensity list. I just love the way she wins. She's a show, isn't she? She's a headline act in that way. Matt doesn't like it so much when people try to push players to his attention for the backhand list. He's quite touchy about it being his own piece of work. Thoughts, Matt?
I mean, this is the Jasmine Paolini apology episode, but I'm afraid she's nowhere near the backhand list.
there's another one to clip up for the future.
I thought you were making a dodgy face when David was saying, what do you think of that backhand? You're thinking, keep away from my list.
A lot of people have actually been trying to get Anna Kalinskaya on the backhand list. And personally, I would say she is closer. Like, I do think her backhand stands out for me a little bit more. I'll be honest, this match happened at pretty much the exact time that Fulham were beating Man United at Old Trafford. And my attention was very much on the football for most of this match. But what I can tell you is that Kalinskaya Paolini was a very underrated, under-the-radar fourth round at the Australian Open just a few weeks ago. It was part of that wide open section of the draw where everyone was wondering who is going to come through. And Kalinskaya beat Paolini pretty handily in Melbourne in straight sets. And for the start of this final in Dubai, the same thing was happening again. Kalinskaya was a set and a break up and really dominating. But in sort of classic Paolini style, just as she did in the first round against Hadash Maia, when she was a set and a break down, she dug in and fought through and managed to turn it around. And personally, I think it's the Paolini forehand, which has got quite a bit of pop on it, and she likes to dictate with that shot if she can. Kalinskaya got very, very tight in those final stages, serving for the match. It was two players on the court. Paolini was there. She was applying pressure, but honestly, Kalinskaya let that final slip, I would say, in those final stages. I think that. My understanding of the WTA highlights is that it is sort of done on a sort of automated system, and therefore you don't see sort of important points. You tend to see good points. And I think that's the reason why there wasn't that much shown from the very latter stages of that match, because the quality did sort of slightly dip at the end because Kalinskaya made some errors. But Paolini was awesome, and what a great story, really. The sort of late blooming, I think she cracked the top 100 5 years ago for the first time. She's now 28. She's at a career high ranking now of 14 in the world. And, you know, she won some very big matches for Italy last year to get them to the Billie Jean King Cup final. Like, she has been stepping up all the way. And yeah, it was just a really impressive run to the title and getting over the line in that final in such dramatic fashion, although not quite as dramatic as Fulham's win at Old Trafford. I will just bring that up yet again.
I knew he was going to weave that into today's show. I didn't know exactly how early on he was going to weave it into today's show, but there you are. Matt described himself as having had a cardiac event when Iwobi scored the winner on Saturday. Not when Jasmine Paolini came back from the brink to win the Dubai title. Just on the WTA YouTube highlights, I don't want to hammer them because I realise the WTA, as I always say when we kind of criticise them, like, they would love to have more resource, and a huge part of why they don't have more resource is the patriarchy. So I give them a lot of grace on that. However, I do believe that YouTube highlights need to be prioritised more highly in resource allocation. They are so important for young viewers, and not even that young viewers. Like, yes, David, your son consumes pretty much everything on YouTube, just as most 12-year-olds and teenagers. But I'm talking under 30s, really. Like, mostly consume this kind of stuff on YouTube via highlights. It is so important for engaging young viewers, and it's just not good enough what the WTA are offering at the moment. Like, I don't really bother with WTA YouTube highlights, and that's extremely poor. They just don't, they can sometimes actively mislead in terms of the story and the narrative of a match. And I'm very rarely watching YouTube highlights because I want to see the best shots. Like, if I want that, I'll just watch a compilation video of best ever Serena Williams points, which are obviously offered to me every time I log into YouTube. If I'm checking out YouTube highlights, it's because I want to know what happened in a match. I want to know where the pinch points were, etc. And their current system, which I think is AI based, or certainly most of the human element has been removed from the process, just simply doesn't give you that. And that's just not good enough. And I think it's a prime example of tennis shooting itself in the foot. So if resource allocators are listening, I would just urge a reconsideration of how critical that is for the WTA. And there's such a stark contrast, isn't there, in the WTA YouTube offering and the ATP. ATP YouTube highlights are really good, and that matters.
Yeah, I mean, and I definitely felt like there were a couple of the matches I had to watch on highlights on the ATP YouTube page, and you just got the feel for where it was won and lost and how, and the feel of it all. And it is a skill in itself, is editing and cutting highlights. And I'm sorry, AI isn't going to have that feel.
Mm, absolutely. Kalinskaya. Obviously an incredible week from her. She beat Yelena Ostapenko, which is really annoying because it ruins the really fun Yelena Ostapenko, Victoria Azarenka tango that they were doing in 2024. She also beat Coco Gauff and Iga Swiatek, straight sets win over Iga Swiatek in the course of a week. And it's obviously a stunning, stunning week for her, and backs up what she did in Australia, which I always think is so important when a player suddenly has a breakthrough run out of nowhere, that they significantly back it up and just confirm for any doubters and maybe for themselves that it wasn't a freak result or a flash in the pan. And yet I feel like that was an opportunity missed to win a 1000 title. You know, it was on her racket.
No, it really was. And actually, it's very hard not to analyse what Kalinskaya achieved this week without doing her down a little bit, because I think in all three of the matches that she won there to get to that final, I'm looking at her opponent and thinking, yeah, Yelena Ostapenko has got this amazing chance to just rip through Coco Gauff and Iga Świątek and win this title. I'm looking at Coco Gauff and I'm thinking, you know, you've got a chance to set up this match against Iga Świątek. And then once she gets to Świątek, I'm thinking, oh, she's going to carry on the run that took her to the title last week. And she, you know, and she could dominate this period. And that does feel really unfair to Anna Kalinskaya, who, because this is not a one-off. This is off the back of the Australian Open, where she had that fantastic run. This is the first year that I have looked at her in a completely different light. She's never been a player that I thought was going to be a contender at this sort of level at all. And she has shown a really compact game and some weapons as well, which I really didn't think she had, and has produced. I don't really know where the line is between where those players didn't produce, though, you know, because all three of them on paper should be beating Kalinskaya.
Yeah, they're players with greater weapons, aren't they? I agree, David, that Kalinskaya showed more force and more weaponry, more artillery than I previously associated her with this week. But she's never going to outgun Coco Gauff or Yelena Ostapenko or Iga Świątek. That's not the way she's going to beat them. She broke them down. She forced them to malfunction. It was such a contrast with Iga Świątek, wasn't it? Kalinskaya has this just lovely smooth technique that looks like it could never really break down, but that she is going to be susceptible to being hit off the court somehow. And then you've got Iga Świątek down the other end of the court, who makes a living out of hitting players off the court. And you felt like that should have been easy for her. But she did say in her post-match press conference she was tired, wasn't she, after the run through Doha. She said she was trying to inject extra power and pace onto the ball, and she just didn't have it. It was erratic, wasn't it, from Świątek? She was spraying the forehand broke down most considerably, I thought, and she didn't quite have it in her to dig her heels in, I thought.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the conversation we had last week in terms of Iga Świątek in those sorts of matches is going to continue to be such a fascinating case study, really, because she does have the legs and the movement and the athleticism to fall back on that if her big hitting isn't working. And yet it seems like she rarely does that. And I think perhaps tiredness is maybe a factor here, and understandably, it's so many matches in such a short period that maybe she just ran out of gas, and maybe actually going for your shots then is easier than trying to extend the rallies. And that was certainly her approach. It did start getting her back in the match. She was a double breakdown, saved some match points, managed to get it to just a single break. And I thought, you know, it felt like she could still win the match, but Kalinskaya showed some very impressive composure there. But yeah, it wasn't peak Świątek. She actually slammed her racket down at one stage and got a very rare code violation. All sort of signs, I suppose, that maybe there was a bit of mental fatigue. But yeah, Kalinskaya, very, very sneaky good start to the year, I would say. Like, she lost to eventual finalist Jung Chin Wen in Australia as well. Like, you know, it wasn't a bad loss she took there. I think her other losses have been Pliskova, who's been in really good form, Azarenka, who's been in good form, and Kasatkina as well. So, like, you're having to be really good to beat Anna Kalinskaya at the moment. She is making opponents work for it. And yeah, it was interesting. You know, you sort of, I think one of the reasons the WTA, certainly this was what Tamani Karyol put in his piece in The Guardian, one of the reasons they made this Middle East swing back-to-back 1,000 events was to sort of try and ramp up the number of big matches, you know, in this period between top players. And then sort of in slightly true classic WTA fashion, you ended up with this Paolini-Kalinskaya final that sort of no one was expecting. And yet again, in true classic WTA fashion, it sort of really delivered and was really entertaining. And I think, it, you know, it sort of would have been a possible first round match that you wouldn't have glanced too much at. You'd have thought, oh, that's a good match, but not much beyond that. And then when you actually watched it in the final, it was like really competitive and sort of back and forth. And it just, I think, just shows the depth. Like there are so many players who are capable of taking these titles on any given week, I suppose.
What do we think of these back-to-back Middle East 1000s on the WTA Tour? And I have to say, it passed me by a bit. Like, I did know somewhere in my consciousness that the WTA had changed their structure and there were going to be more 500s and 1000s, but I hadn't quite processed what that would look like this year. There are going to be 10 WTA 1000 events and elevating, you know, they used to switch Doha and Dubai and alternate each year between which one of them is 1,000. They're now both 1,000s and they're flanked by 500s. You've got a 500 this week in San Diego and a 500 the week prior to Doha in Abu Dhabi. It feels like a lot to me. It feels like there's a sort of zero sum amount of caring and stakes. You can't artificially create stakes, right? You can't have a Grand Slam tournament every week of the year, or else a Grand Slam wouldn't mean what it means. Now, I know there are other periods of the calendar. We've had long standing back to back 1,000 events: Madrid and Rome, Cincinnati, and Canada. But I don't know. Maybe it would just take some getting used to. It felt like a bit much to me.
Yeah, personally, I didn't love it. I think one of the things about the back-to-back Masters 1000 events at other times in the year is that they're building to slams, really, aren't they? I suppose Indian Wells and Miami, less so, but they're just such big events, they can sort of stand alone. But, you know, Cincinnati and Canada build up to the US Open, and Rome and Madrid build up to Roland Garros. And this is kind of like, well, what's it building to? And I think exactly as you said, premium events are premium because there's not that many of them. And I just think it felt like a little bit too much to me. And I think we saw that, honestly, with the players and with some of the performances. Like, it was a bit of a strange week. You know, Rybakina has played a lot of tennis, sort of not that much of a surprise that she ended up sort of feeling it and falling ill. It wasn't my favorite change, to be honest. I don't think you need 2 1,000 events in February. You know, we've just had the Australian Open, and it's a period with so many tournaments that I can see why maybe they wanted to elevate some of them. But for me, it didn't quite work. I think personally, I preferred it when it was 2 500s building up to 1,000 event in February for the WTA. It's emphasized also by the fact that the crowds are not that great in the, you know, in especially in the day session matches in this part of the calendar. And therefore, it doesn't feel all that premium either. You know, you've got sort of empty stadiums. It just doesn't feel like the other 1,000 events do. And to have that back to back, it sort of made it hard to think that they were both, you know, both as big as Indian Wells in a couple of weeks. It just didn't feel like that. And I think feeling is sort of a, you know, it's very important. It's part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good point. So the WTA this week are in San Diego. That's a 500. Jessica Pegula making her return to the tour there. And there's also a 250 event in Austin, which has Sloane Stephens, Danielle Collins, Angelina Kalinina is the top seed there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Moving on to the ATP events from the week just gone, starting in Rio, where there was a 500 event. Spare a thought for Rio. I mean, it kind of all ended up okay, and they had the incredible breakthrough of local guy João Fonseca, which I think made up for so much. And I'm so pleased that they did have that, because my goodness me, it was a rough start to the week. It rained pretty much solidly for about the first 4 days of this tournament, and they lost Carlos Alcaraz in the third game of his first match against Thiago Monteiro with an ankle sprain. It was a horrific opening to this tournament, wasn't it, David?
Yeah, and actually this week in general felt a bit like that. It felt like it was a bit after the Lord Mayor's show, because, and I think a lot of that is because a lot of players are fatigued and people are breaking down. Obviously, Alcaraz getting injured in the second game or third game, that's just bad luck. But you know, you've just touched on all the players, like Rybakina having to pull out, Świątek running out of gas, you know, and it was a bit like that in South America as well. You're asking a lot of these players to go back to back to back. Now, I suppose they don't have to all play them, but it did make it feel as though, yeah, it was one too many in a row. And I am relieved that Fonseca had the run that he had, because he was a surprise to me. When I told you two about him, you reminded me where we've heard of him from. What was the junior event that he did so well at?
He won the US Open Juniors last year.
Right. And you see, I turned on his first round match, because he was facing Artur Fils. And I was looking forward to watching this young, big-hitting, physical player just loving the clay and knocking an opponent off the court and starting the run that I keep saying that he's going to have. And it very much happened. It's just that it was the other bloke who did it all. And Fonseca was absolutely awesome. I mean, he won that match 6-love, 6-4. And, I mean, Fils could not make an impact on him at all. And partly that's because Fils was absolutely terrible and he just kept on missing rally balls. He clearly had no confidence at all. But Fonseca's just got a liquid arm, an elasticity to the way he hits the ball. And it did make me... It's a very easy comparison and parallel to make, because he's Brazilian and because the crowd loved him and because he clearly loved the crowd. It's very easy to make a comparison to Gustavo Kuerten. But actually, watching them hit the ball and unload with this rather spindly frame, but then suddenly producing this knockout power, quite similar. And he definitely gave me feel-good vibes, even though my guy was getting a trouncing.
He was feel good vibes, wasn't he? He grew up 10 minutes away from the club where the Rio Open is held. I think he's the first player born in 2006 to win a match on the ATP tour, which I think might make even Matt feel old. I also read that he's been the beneficiary of the ATP, a system that the ATP have. It's called some sort of next gen accelerator program, where really promising juniors that achieve a certain level of junior results are kind of given a leg up into the Challenger Tour to accelerate their development in the pros. And he's been playing Challenger tennis all year via that scheme and got a wild card as the local boy into this tournament and just lit the place up, reaching the quarterfinals, backed it up by beating Christian Garin, didn't he? Which, look, I know Christian Garin isn't the player he was when he was a middling South American having a run during a pandemic, but you know, he's a hardened pro, isn't he? I thought Fonseca would come unstuck against Green. I thought he'd just be too solid for him, and I was so impressed. Why are we laughing at me?
Well, I was going to say, hang on. No, Christian Garin was the guy who was most screwed over by the pandemic. Wasn't he like leading the race or something?
Yeah, that's what I mean. And he had his best results in early 2020, didn't he?
Yeah, it was just before COVID struck. It's the thing no one talks about with COVID. What would Christian Garin have done had it not?
They came up with a makeshift ranking system, didn't they, to try and sustain the rankings through COVID when those tennis is happening. But I think there was also a sub aim of the ranking system, which was let's make sure Christian Garin doesn't qualify for the ATP finals.
Yeah, it was harsh. Poor Christian. But yeah, interesting you make the Gustavo Kuerten comparison, and you know, certainly it was incredible the way, you know, the support that he was receiving. It was like a Davis Cup tie out there for his matches. And I mean, personally, what you said there about just incredible power from quite a small frame made me think of Jannik Sinner in terms of that element. Like some of the shots I woke up to the highlights of, you know, just the ball just pinging off his strings, this whiplash power. It's just very exciting, I think, when someone can hit the ball that hard and yet sort of still have control over it. I just think that will always be fun to watch. He's obviously kitted out in the Iga Świątek on clothing, which is, you know, seems like a good thing to do if you want to have results on clay. So look, I think he's now got a wild card into Santiago as well, so we'll get to watch him again this week.
He looked like an Iga Świątek impersonator, didn't he? I know, you know, most kits are worn by more than one player, but because I can't think of any other female players that wear the on-running kit. Obviously, Ben Shelton, most notably, wears the men's version, but he never wears sort of the male version of Iga Świątek's kit. It was really like, oh, it's Iga Świątek in the body of a 17-year-old boy. Well, that was the reaction I had anyway. So yeah, João Fonseca, remember the name. He's one to watch for sure. But he didn't win the tournament. We should probably talk about Sebastian Baez. He beat Mariano. Help me out here. I'm going to go Navone.
Yeah, that's what my commentator was saying.
Great. He beat Mariano Navone 6-2, 6-1 in the final. I'm gonna need more help with old Mariano here. Someone tell me something about him.
He's the bloke who beat Fonseca. That's the villain I knew. He did not come up trumps in that final, though. I mean, he looked he looked pretty nervous early on. I mean, he got his first game on the board when he was four love down, and he did the full sort of, you know, come with me crowd sort of signal. And I thought, okay, here we go. And then he didn't really win another game for about half an hour. I have to be honest, I was paying more attention to the other guy, Sebastian Byers, down the other end of the court, because I feel like I've been watching him ever since he should have beaten Alexander Zverev at the French Open 2 years ago. It's felt like he has such a perfect game for clay that, I mean, I know a lot of players do, but he just looks like he'd be a nightmare to play on clay. Like he could play every day of his life on that surface and still come back for more. Hence why I put him in my predictions to win the tournament 2 weeks ago, and he did it 2 weeks late. But anyway, I'll try to forgive him for that. Can't provide that much intel on the opponent, though, I'm afraid.
Yeah, he's also Argentinian, Navone. There was this day in Rio where I think it was a sort of series of Brazil-Argentina matchups, and Argentina won the lot. I think all of the Brazilian players just went out kind of on the same day. And I mean, looking at his record, he made a big burst at the end of last season on the Challenger Tour after the US Open, reached a bunch of finals. I watched him play Cameron Norrie in the semi-finals here, and poor Cameron Norrie was, I mean, I felt like he needed to retire. Like he was just really struggling in the conditions. He just looked really ill. And Navone was just far too sort of good for him really on that day. But yeah, Baez, obviously Argentinian as well. And he has this habit, Baez, of picking up titles. Like, remember, I mean, last year he won Kitzbühel and Winston-Salem back to back and went into the US Open on this incredible winning streak. And I think made it to the third round. And I think we were talking about his match against Medvedev. We were like, is Medvedev in trouble here? Like, Baez is on like a 12-match winning streak or something. And, you know, he's lost to Medvedev at the US Open last year. He lost to Sinner at the Australian Open this year. So it's taking really good players to beat him. And, yeah, he's got a really good technique, I always think, on the forehand, Baez. He can create such power, and you know, especially on clay. And, yeah, it's his biggest title so far, winning at 500 level for the first time. And yeah, he's just maintaining that habit of picking up titles, which is not to be sniffed at, because there are good players who don't win titles, and he's won quite a handful now.
Yeah, very true. It was worrying, wasn't it, seeing Carlos Alcaraz go over on his ankle in his match against Thiago Monteiro. Looked potentially quite bad at the time. Did come out with a statement the next day, though, reassuring everybody, saying it's just a sprain, and he will be back for Indian Wells. And I hope that's not him, you know, being overeager and pushing it. I desperately want him to be fit for Indian Wells, but just only play if you're fit, Carlos. I know you're ravenous, but just, it's okay. The ATP was also in Doha this week. The title was won by Karen Khachanov, beat Jakub Mensik in the final, 7-6, 6-4, and much like João Fonseca in Rio, it does feel, to me at least, David, like Mensik was the story of Doha this week.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, it's another example of a player that doesn't tend to get the headlines, arguably even if he wins the tournament, because Karen Khachanov, I don't know how you'd ever do a review of it, but I think he could be the player above all other that reaches the seeding that he has of every draw. He never lets you down. He doesn't often sort of go beyond that, but he was second seed here, got to the final. Okay, the top seed didn't win, so Khachanov won. But you're right, I come out of this tournament remembering Jakub Mensik, who I think I first really took paid attention to at the US Open. And since then, there have been a number of times when he's been in draws, if you walk past a match that he's on the grounds of a tournament or a qualifying, he really grabs your attention. He's tall. He's got a huge game. He seems fearless. He just puts his game on you. And this week was a proper breakout week. I mean, this guy has got something that is going to hurt a lot of players, at least at first glance. And he's backed it up, you know, to get, it's not just a single victory. He's gone all the way to the final. And I'm really pleased to see somebody with clearly some raw materials produce some results early on to back that up.
Yeah. And he's another one who used the new ATP scheme to even get into this tournament. I believe because of his age and because of his ranking, he was entitled to enter one ATP 250 event this year. And he chose to do that really early with Doha. And he's totally, you know, delivered on it. But that being said, he had a tough draw. I mean, we watched him come through an absolute grueling epic against Andy Murray. Murray will have a lot of regrets about a missed volley on top of the net in the first set tiebreak. But Mensik, you know, dug in and managed to win that one that went the distance. And then I was just really impressed that he backed it up against Andrei Rublev in the next round. Like, it's a very impressive win from someone so young. I felt like Rublev would just have too much pace, but Mensik, despite having a big game himself, actually absorbed Rublev's pace really well. And he beat Monfils in another pretty grueling match. By that point, I felt like he was really starting to get a little bit tired. And then in the final, yeah, I mean, it's classic Karen Khachanov as a kind of gatekeeper, really. I mean, he's beaten two young players there in Popperin and Mensik back to back, and he won the first set on the tiebreak in both. And in both, it was a 14-12 tiebreak, you know, sort of epic first set that Khachanov won, and then managed to come through the second set just a bit more easily. Like, remember when Jannik Sinner beat Khachanov so convincingly at Australian Open this year, it was a sign of Jannik Sinner having gone up another level, you know. And I just think Khachanov is very much that guy. You know, he's not going to lose matches that he shouldn't lose very often. And it takes a heck of a performance to beat him. But Mensik showed a lot. He's qualified for two straight slams, now reached the final of an ATP event. And like, there's a really interesting crop of Czech young male players for the first time in ages now, with Lehečka and Mahač and Mensik. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see if they can sort of try and follow in the footsteps of the WTA Czech players, who've obviously been, you know, there've been so many of them and they've been so successful for so long. But it's interesting that it's now happening to the men a little bit more.
Yep, Jakub Mensik, remember the name, and congratulations to Karen Khachanov, who won the title. The ATP was also in Los Cabos this week, and the title, or should I say titles, were won by Jordan Thompson, the singles and the doubles, and he played the singles final, the doubles final, and the doubles semi-final all on the same day. I tried to find a way that we could lead with Jordan Thompson in this podcast, but with WTA Dubai being a 1000, it just didn't feel right. But my goodness me, Jordan Thompson, David, what unreal what he pulled off this week.
Yeah, I watched a lot of him actually over the course of the week. And I mean, you know, to put it into perspective, his quarterfinal, he was love 6, 1-4, 15-40 down against Alex Mickelson, you know, and he went and won that. And then he played against Zverev in the semifinals, a match that was 3 hours 40 minutes. And he eventually won that as well in a final set tiebreak. And it's tough to beat Zverev in those long matches. And then he beats Casper Ruud in the singles final. And I mean, there were a couple of funny moments in post-match interviews where the interviewer was like, "And now the doubles." and it was like early hours of the morning. And he just goes, after the semi-final against Zverev, and this was said to him, he just goes, "Brutal." And I then looked on the sort of live scoreboard, because this, you know, the doubles matches were not getting shown on TV, on live TV, or even on tennis TV, which I thought was, yeah, it's poor, that. I mean, I think that's what happens at 250s. and or at least some of them. And I looked at the live scoring, and he just wasn't appearing. And I thought, oh, he's just bagged it, which, you know, is totally understandable if he has. Oh, no. He just came out and he played all of the matches on the final day instead, and he won both titles. And great scene. See, you know, that's his first title. It's massive. And he's one of those players that has been around for years, and he's had some good wins and he's had some good years, but they've never really been much different to one another. And then suddenly here he is just elevating his level and going and winning this. And it was a great achievement. And by the way, a wonderful trophy that they have, that they lift for the singles champion there. Multicoloured. I'm not sure exactly whether there's a meaning particularly behind the trophy, but it's absolutely beautiful. I would say one of the nicest looking trophies on the tour.
Partnered by Max Purcell, should say, in the doubles, who's a Grand Slam doubles champion, isn't he? So scored himself a good partner there. Beat Casper Ruud twice in one day, beat him in the singles final and the doubles semi-final, which sounds bad for Casper Ruud, but actually this was a pretty massive week for him, actually. I read that he's already got more hard court victories this year now than he had in the entirety of 2023. I still don't really know what to think about what the year might have in store for Casper Ruud. Last year was so weird, wasn't it? One French Open final and pretty much nothing else. And, you know, the year before that, he was a match away from being world number one. But I think this was a good week for him.
Yes, I agree. I thought that was a good win in the semi-final over Tsitsipas. And I guess my expectation of Ruud is somewhere between his last two seasons. Like, I don't think he's going to be a match away from world number one again, but I really don't think he's going to be, you know, bombing out of tournaments and really struggling to win matches. And I think he will always be a threat at the French Open. Like, I don't know whether he's going to reach the final again, but if he's in the right bit of the draw, as he has been for a couple of years, he's a surer bet there than a lot of players that we might have thought so in the past. Like, I don't know, Rune or Tsitsipas. You know, I think I would back Ruud above both of those at the moment at the French Open. So I sort of expect him to finish the year, I guess, around 10 in the world, something like that. Maybe knocking on the door of qualifying for Turin. But the signs have been a little bit better this season so far.
The ATP this week is in Acapulco, where Zverev is playing again. He lost to Jordan Thompson in the semi-finals, and Rune as well. They're the top two seeds. The ATP is also in Dubai, which is what's on my telly at the moment. Andy Murray is embroiled in a match that I'm sure will be going on for the next 3 hours with Denis Shapovalov. Defending champion there is Daniel Medvedev, and it's his long-awaited return to the tour after Australia. He took a long break after that, and he's added Gilles Simon to his coaching setup. So we'll be watching that very closely. And the ATP is also in Santiago this week, where Sebastian Baez tries to continue his run, and Nicholas Jarry is in action as well. You mentioned Holger Rune, Matt. He features in our news section this week. Two items in this section of the show. Both news items that I read via Twitter, and I checked the dates thoroughly on both tweets. One was the announcement that Holger Rune is working with Patrick Mouratoglou again. And the other is the announcement that Ivo Karlovic has retired. I thought we were over retirement announcements from players born in the 70s. But here we are. He is 44 years old, David. And what a career. But I did think it was a career that ended about half a decade ago, I have to say.
Yes, I think he kind of also thought it was over several years ago. And I think it just got sufficiently pointed out to him a number of times by people that he'd never actually announced his retirement. And so is he going to make a comeback? And, you know, he just sort of decided not to play.
Who were these people that were sitting at home wondering if Ivo Karlovic was poised to make a comeback?
I don't know. I always remember Thomas Muster never made an official retirement announcement back in the day, and I think maybe even John McEnroe as well. There's a few over the years. Maybe John McEnroe is going to make a comeback. No, but I think that people like finality. Journalists, fans, they like, and associations, you want to be able to, you know, pay tribute to the player in some way. And if they don't retire, if they don't actually call the end of their career, how can you do it? So maybe that a few people were just wanting to do that. But it was amusing to me. And he signed his tweet Dr. Evo, which is the old name that people used to give him back in the day. But I mean, look, I remember he first came to my attention, give you an idea of how old he is. My first year on tour, 1998, in the UMAG tournament, which is where I met my wife that year as well. And I also met Ivo Karlovic. and he was...
What a duo.
And he was the first player.
Two life-altering events for David.
I'd never seen a player that tall. I mean, you know, and it was creating a lot of conversation. So I, of course, arranged a photo shoot with him and, what was the guy's name?
Yourself? David Law?
Juan Antonio Marin. I did a photo shoot with these two players. And obviously you've got Ivo Karlovic, who's 6'11", I think he is, or 10, and Juan Antonio Marin, lovely chap, not the same sort of height whatsoever. In fact, he was
David?
1.75 meters, and that's a good sort of 35 centimetres short.
Taller than me.
Shorter.
I thought you were going to say sort
five
of...
5 foot nine.
Okay. I see what you've done
he
there,
was
David.
Never 5 foot
you've,
nine.
You've
he
done
was
a kind of
never.
Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger type thing.
Yeah. I did it before Diego Schwartzman was even a thing. and anyway, so but I mean, honestly, the problem was Karlovic was rubbish. I mean, he couldn't win matches on tour. He couldn't win matches on tour. Never thought he would become a player of any significance whatsoever. And then 5 years later, I mean, he worked incredibly hard on his game. And he was, 5 years later, he's the first round opponent of Leighton Hewitt, the defending Wimbledon champion. He beat him in the first round. And that was probably the biggest Wimbledon shock we'd ever seen. And he ended up having a really good career, Karlovic. He was a lot of trouble for a lot of players. And, quite an interesting character who I often think social media, for some players, does them a disservice. They end up becoming less of a personality by being on social media. He's the opposite. He's a player who suffered badly with a stammer when he was young and was unable to do on-court interviews and so forth. I remember a couple of times he came over and he said, "Do you mind if I don't do the on-court interview?" and stuff like that. And yet on Twitter, he was really funny and able to just get his personality across in that way.
We quite often talk, don't we, about, you know, we sort of name a player and say, what would we do if they retired? And quite often the answer is sort of, oh, just 2 or 3 minutes at the end of the podcast. But actually, I sort of feel like we're going quite deep here on Ivo Karlovic, because I feel like I have stuff to say as well. like, it blew my mind that he won a title on clay. Like, he won titles on three different surfaces, eight altogether. And I just think that shows just how good his serve was. Like, to me, he's the best server I've seen, because the rest of his game was not all that much. I mean, you know, he had a nice slice backhand and he could occasionally flatten out his forehand and sort of rip it. But basically, you know, he had nowhere near the ground strokes that John Isner had, for example, or that Riley Opelka has. But his serve was phenomenal. I do think in terms of measurements, like most likely to hit an ace with your serve or, you know, hold percentage. I think Ivo Karlovic is right at the top of those stats. And it was always sort of quite sad and amusing to me. I remember reading an article on the ATP website once about the fact that he just couldn't get practice partners. You know, he would write his name down on the list and then he'd come back the next day and no one had signed up to be next to him because they didn't want to practice with him. But, you know, that serve was such a weapon. He got wins over Federer and Djokovic. And I think he's one of the oldest ATP champions ever. Like, it was a game that aged well because of how, you know, I think he learned to understand his own game. He got better as well, as David said. And also, you know, he can probably still serve extremely well. I think he will always sort of have that shot. It was sort of an economical game that he could keep playing later in his career. So yeah, he was not a fun player to play against, but I always actually found him quite a fun sort of presence on the tour. It was always just interesting when Karlovic was playing. How can the opponent figure him out?
And for anyone thinking, well, he's 7 feet tall, of course he's got a good serve. How much credit do you deserve for that 7 feet tall? I would have thought the same until I saw David play.
Savage.
Honestly, how good was I the other day, Matt?
And no and serving though, was there? You were good. You were no. Both really good. I was very impressed. But it's even murkier a mystery to me. Your serve, David, after seeing you throw last week.
I know.
David throwing the ball. David has an arm on him, folks.
I was practicing my serve yesterday with my kids who are, you know, 12 and 14, right? And it went through my head. Catherine says I've got a good arm when I was hitting my serve. I was thinking,
David,
I should be able to do
Ben
this.
Shelton throwing the ball for Billie Jean.
So I'm thinking I should be able to do this. Honestly, my kids are returning my serve as if it's nothing. And I don't know what's the problem.
Well, Andy Roddick is now a freelance serve consultant, isn't he? So
yes.
Andy, if you're listening, he's got his own podcast.
You have to be American.
He's not listening. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
You know, I don't think nationality is the key element there.
I haven't got in touch. We don't know.
Guys, we need to cover the weirdest... what even is it? I can't find the words. Holger Rune and Patrick Mouratoglou are back together. The toxic relationship that just won't go away. What do we have to say about this, folks?
Well, it was a surprise, I suppose. but then there's a lot that Holger Rune does that is a surprise to me. He's gone through in the space of... I mean, he's already had Patrick Mouratoglou apparently as his coach twice before. And what is he? How old is he? 20. And now he's got him as his coach again. He's also had Boris Becker and Severin Luthi as his coach in the interim. I mean, it's a very strange run of coaching appointments generally. What do I have to say about it? Look, he had good results when Patrick Mouratoglou was around, and that appears to be his thinking on the subject. From a Mouratoglou perspective, though, I did hear that news and see his tweet reaction to it and think, shouldn't you just be pulling your neck in a little bit at the moment, given that the player that you were supposed to be coaching is going through a 4-year ban, which he's appealing to CAS at the moment? And rather than putting yourself up in lights yet again as coaching the next big thing, and, you know, tweeting about it, in reference to how somebody's written such a good way of highlighting how they're going to work together. And I'm thinking, yeah, but the article you're promoting is on your own website. So it's not like some independent journalist has thought, oh, I'm going to write about what a good idea this is. No, it's on your website, Patrick. So forgive me if I don't take that seriously. And I just think generally, you know, The point has been made in the last week by Andy Roddick, actually, and Kim Kleister's in conversation on his show, that really, maybe it is time for players that test positive to also have their coaches and their teams under the spotlight, and maybe not allowed to just keep coaching and everybody else as if that had never happened. And there are no rules to that effect. Patrick can carry on doing exactly what he likes. Anybody he wants can hire him, and it appears that it makes no difference at all. But I'd be embarrassed personally if I was in that situation, and I probably would not want to be out in the spotlight again until that was resolved satisfactorily.
There was a very odd sequence of events on Twitter. That's a reusable phrase, where Holger Rune made his announcement for getting back together with Mouratoglu. Someone replied something about pertaining to the relationship with Simona Halep and what she's going through now, saying, you know, be careful what supplements you take or what you put in your body or something. And Rune's reply, whether this was from him or his mum, but we know at times in the past his mum has run his social media, don't know whether that's happening now. The reply was, my mum's in charge of everything I put in my body, so no issues there. I just thought, oh my God, there's so many things wrong with this situation. I don't know where to begin. It just seems like utter chaos, Camp Arena. Even if this turns out to be a productive relationship, whatever you think about it, it's just, it all speaks of chaos. And, you know, I just, even removing the Mouratoglu of it all, Rune saying, my mom is in charge of what I put in my body. Like, okay, he's a young man, but he is a man. And, you know, I've been talking a lot this year about, you know, the players that see, I don't think it's an accident that players that are seeing success and happiness are players that are sort of taking responsibility for themselves and their actions. And yes, calling on people and having teams and not being an island, it's impossible to be in this sport, but being in charge of those teams and realizing that they're at the helm of all this, they're at the helm of their own careers and they are responsible for themselves. And that is absolutely not what Holger Rune is giving in any meaningful way at the moment. And I worry about that. So we will see. We will see how this one pans out. And that is your lot, I think, for this week on the Tennis Podcast, except to tell you about Delilah. Hey there, Delilah. I'm sure you've heard that one before. Delilah is owned by Carolyn. Carolyn says, my wife and I adopted Delilah and her brother Jug in late 2019. She likes watching most sport. I should say Delilah's a cat. I feel like I should know the name of this type of cat. She's that sort of minky coloured with light blue eyes. She's absolutely stunning. She likes watching most sports on TV and doesn't seem to favour any tennis players yet. Delilah and Jug is an interesting name combo, isn't it? How did you choose between your cats, Carolyn, as to who would be... who would be the chosen one for mascotdom? Who knows? But anyway, Delilah is absolutely gorgeous and she has that totally...
Is that not a Siamese cat?
Is it a Siamese? I was going to say that, but then I questioned myself and thought, I don't know.
I've just Googled one and it looks very similar.
Yeah. Carolyn, please let us know. Gosh, she's absolutely gorgeous. Is Delilah? She's got that totally indignant "f you" expression on her face, which is my favourite thing about cats. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin, who I failed to score points for yet again, but I will continue to try and honour Darwin's memory. I'm sure I'll pull it off at some point. David has Francis and Matt has Hyder and Soma. The extremely stinky Billie Jean has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. She rolled in something absolutely abhorrent earlier. It's It was a terrible, terrible situation. We have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We start with Paula Ann Check, who is in Arlington, Virginia.
Arlington. Oh, hi, Paula.
Oh, I was going to say Arlington, Texas.
No, Virginia.
Okay.
Which is where I've been. I've been to Arlington Cemetery. It's one of the...
You've been to Arlington, Virginia?
Yes. It's one of the big national cemeteries. I think it's
where
JFK is buried.
Now that you've said that, it rings a bell from the West Wing, which means it will probably ring a bell for David as well.
Yes, as I work my way through into season 7 now, just started. Am I allowed to have Paula Badosa?
Yes, same spelling.
Okay.
Oh, same spelling. Fantastic.
Great. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you. Hang on, Paula. Thank you, Paula/Paula. Thank you very much.
We've also got David Moreno. We know David.
We know David.
He is Spanish-German living in Brussels.
Hey.
And from the Church of David. How's your serve, David?
he says that he saved money for 10 years in order to make a dream come true, which was to fly to Melbourne and attend the Australian Open. And he picked 2017. He had tickets for every single day except the semis, which he watched in Garden Square. And he says his highlights of the trip were attending the Federer-Nadal final, but also having a pic taken with David Law.
Wow, what a tournament. David and David.
I remember it well, yeah.
Absolutely love that, David. Thank you.
And finally, we have Donna Parker.
All right, Donna.
Hello, Donna.
Like
Donna Vekic.
And, you know, it is perfect because Donna is from Maryland, which is where Pam Shriver is from. Donna
Vekic's coach. It's all coming together. Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah. Although perfect. Donna's actually from Fulton, Maryland.
Okay.
Okay.
Don't know that one.
She is a long time US Open attendee, but heading to Roland Garros this year.
Oh, you're going to love it, Donna. I'm telling you.
You are. Best of luck to Donna in San Diego. Donna and Pam in San Diego this week. Pam's being stopped by Tennis Podcast listeners, sending us photos. Brilliant.
Excellent.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast. Hope you're excited about what we've got coming for you, starting with that live show this Thursday. If you'd like to become a friend of the pod, the link to do so is in our show notes. That's your lot for this week. We'll speak to you next Monday.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.